Members, the House Committee on Elections will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, so we can't move the minutes or do anything official, but I'd like to get going because I think we'll have a good discussion today. We're going to start out with Representative Norton's House File 122. Hopefully we'll have a quorum in time to vote on it, but thanks, Representative Norton. And we have members, as I think you were made aware, I hope you were, we're going to go right from Representative Norton's House File 122, which addresses a certain important situation in a nonpartisan election context, and we're going to jump from that into a discussion, which will, I think, soon turn into a bill, but a discussion on how the committee thinks we ought to handle the partisan version of vacancies on the ballot that Representative Norton is talking about, and just have a good, candid, bipartisan discussion. Obviously, we've got to do this in a bipartisan way, and there's been some sort of menu items suggested by others about how we might want to proceed. Representative Sanders and I have just set up offline, had an informal discussion about it, but I think we have some pretty broad agreement about how to do that. So without any delay, I will move that House File 122 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. So Representative Norton, with that, go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have a DE1 amendment, and I'm not sure the copies have been brought down yet. Do you have them yet?
Ms. Fraser?
Not yet.
Well, in the meantime, maybe, Representative Norton, if you could just talk about the issue generally.
Absolutely. Yeah. I will. And I'm going to give a little bit of history for folks. So today I'm bringing forward a bill that will address several situations that have occurred since the legislature several years ago made changes in law regarding elections. And while they were not unanticipated at the time those changes were made, I believe they were considered rare enough at the time that they would just move ahead with kind of a general law change. And the situations, those rare incidents actually occurred fairly quickly after the law was changed. And so time has demonstrated that that changes need to be made. It's going to save heartache for families and communities, and I'm going to describe for you briefly what happened this past summer in Rochester. The filings opened in May for City Council President Denny Hansen's seat. There was no question that he would be running again for the position that he loved. Seldom without a smile or a sense of humor, Denny had served Rochester well as a dedicated and collegial City Council President. During the filing period, one other resident put their name in for that position, telling Denny at the time that no one should run unopposed. A few weeks later, on June 27th, Denny Hansen, who was 57 years old, died during the night of a brain aneurysm. His stunned family and community were faced with an unexpected loss and pain that such an event brings. As a few days unfolded after the tragedy, they were faced yet again with another shock, and that is that the vacant City Council President seat was not really going to be vacant, but that the only remaining candidate left would be the only viable candidate on the ballot come time for election. And so the law, as it was changed, had no options for the city. There were laws in place for in the city's charter so that they could fill the vacant position immediately, but there was nothing that could be done in law to change the how the election would occur. So it really gave the community three options, and I'm sure you know these, but I'm just going to mention them. And that was to move ahead as it was with the deceased candidate, the City Council President's name on the ballot, and the one other filee. And so the other options that were left was to do write-in campaigns. And some of you may not know that Rochester is a town of over 100,000 now. And it's the City Council President race, unlike other City Council seats, actually is an at-large position. So it would mean trying to do a write-in for the entire city of 100,000 individuals, and that poses a challenge at that time. And also, Denny's family, the third option, was that they could run a campaign. And what a difficult thing to ask a family to do just a few short days after the death of a loved one at such a young age and without any notification planning or awareness. It just happened. So it was hardly fair on the family, and yet that was the option that they felt Denny would have wanted them to pursue. And so Denny's family and his community started their campaign. So to make a long story and long summer and fall for the family short, Denny did win the election, and now Rochester is faced with an open seat and a primary and general election. The filing period has just been these last couple weeks. And so here we start again with that process. And the good news is democracy will be upheld, and I think we all feel good about that. During that process, there was a town hall meeting held, and we invited local leaders, citizens, and all legislators in the area to come together and talk about what we could do. We brainstormed a lot of ideas. Nothing was optimal. Since that time, I've met with the Secretary of State staff to say, what could we do? What is the very best option that we have? And Representative Sanders and some others were at several meetings to discuss that, and what you have before you is the result of those meetings. And so just quickly, the Section A states that if two candidates file and one removes his or her name in the two-day withdrawal period, then the position could be reposted. The Section B states, and that's the section that's directly related to our incidents in Rochester and others that could happen around the state, that if due to a death, there's only one living candidate after the filing and withdrawal period or after a primary election, and that death occurs 85 days before the general election, then the position could be reopened for a five-day filing period, and that those names would then be posted for election during the general election time. So working within the state and federal laws, these are the, you know, it's not perfect, but this is the option that we have before us that will allow, will meet the HAVA requirements and other state and federal laws and allow democracy to come to realization. It's what we all want, people to have a choice and have a good democratic process. And so I bring this before you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Norton. As you said, there are no perfect options. And I think, as we'll get into later, members, with the discussion in the partisan context, it's sort of an array of somewhat unappetizing options. We've got to pick sort of the least bad among them. There is no perfect way to remedy this. And it is interesting, as you said, Representative Norton, that, you know, at the time that the law was sort of tweaked and redrafted, some of these situations seem such remote possibilities. But then when they do happen, we find ourselves having to come back here. And that's natural because we can't predict absolutely every outcome. I don't know. Do we have the amendment yet, Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair, it does not look like it. May I add a couple of
go ahead.
Notes?
Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. I would add two pieces to Representative Norton's description of this. One is that this bill differentiates between judicial candidates and other nonpartisan candidates for office, local candidates. And for judicial candidates, there is always the opportunity for a primary. There always has been in state law. Whereas for local offices, the legislature has given at least cities and school boards the option of whether or not to have a primary. And so this distinguishes between judicial and local candidates and says that for judicial candidates, there's only a vacancy in nomination if one or two of the candidates withdraws during the withdrawal period, in which case there would be an opportunity for a primary, avoiding the situation that we had in the 10th Judicial District in 2010, in which there were 23 judicial candidates on the general election ballot, and voters found it very difficult to learn enough about the candidates to make an informed decision. Whereas for local candidates, since some localities already don't have primaries, having the legislature decide that there's an option where they wouldn't have a primary isn't doesn't stray from that precedent, and would allow for multiple names to be on a general election ballot in the case of a death after the end of the filing and withdrawal period. The other thing I want to note is the 84 days and why that was chosen. So this says basically if a candidate dies more than 84 days before the general election, that there would be an opportunity for a replacement candidate. And the reason that date was chosen is that that allows a five-day filing period and a two-day withdrawal period by the 77th day before the election, which this past year would have been August 28th or 27th, 28th. And that is right now the latest deadline in statute for making any changes to the general election ballot. That's the deadline for major political parties to provide the names of their presidential and vice presidential candidates. And after that date, everything on the general election ballot is basically set. Mm-hmm. Counties are then able to proceed with proofing their ballots, getting the equipment programmed, and printing so that they can mail out their ballots the federally required 46 days before the general election. So those are the two things I wanted to add to the description of the bill, and it looks like we do now have the amendments.
Okay, we do have the amendments, and the way we're going to do this, as I understand, is there's a delete everything amendment followed by an amendment to that amendment. And members, just so you know, as a matter of procedure, and we've just discussed with Representative Sanders as well, this was something that a sort of drafting issue, a technical drafting issue that came to our attention yesterday afternoon. And so normally we want a little bit more notice than that, but I think in this situation, and I think Representative Sanders agreed, that I think this is appropriate. And so if Representative Norton, I don't know if you want to explain the amendment, or would you rather defer to Ms. Fraser on explaining kind of what we're doing here, the technical part?
Certainly, and I can just briefly describe it. If she wants to go into more detail, she certainly can.
Representative Norton.
And I do want to apologize. I had expected testimony from our local folks, but the flu is going around, and they were unable to come. So we're doing it without them. The DE1 amendment simply moves this piece of legislation, the bill that we had drafted. It changes the citation and places it in a different place in the statute books. And I think the thought was it would be then with the actual procedures, it would be linked with the procedures that one would follow, so they weren't separate in the statute book. So it's for ease. So that was the First Amendment. It's just a placement move. It didn't change any of the language in the bill other than that.
Okay. And as I understand it, Ms. Fraser, if you can just validate that, my understanding is this is just for ease of use, put it in a place of statute where it makes sense. It's not a substantive change. It's just a recodification. Is that true?
That's right, Mr. Chair. Currently, both partisan candidates and nonpartisan candidates' vacancies and nominations are in the same section of law. And so there are a couple subdivisions on partisan and then one on nonpartisan and then partisan, and it just makes it somewhat confusing to find the right sections to read. So this creates a new section for nonpartisan candidates. So I believe Section 2 of the bill is identical to Section 2 of the bill as introduced. Section 1 of the bill is also identical to Section 1 of the bill as introduced. And then it takes a section of law that we were not changing and moves it into this new section of law. So it looks like new law, but it is identical to what's currently in the statute book. It's just putting it all together.
Okay.
And it repeals the current law.
Okay. I'll move the amendment then. I'll move the DE1 amendment. Members, any questions or comments on the DE1 amendment? Okay. All in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. And now to the amendment to what is now the amended bill, the A1 amendment. Who wants to speak on that one?
I could just mention that briefly, too, and then
Representative Norton
can have follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This actually, as we drafted it and read it, we realized that we hadn't addressed what would happen if a primary had already occurred and there were two candidates at that point. And so this says if you have two candidates after a primary and someone should die at that point, that is still the 84 days out, that it could be refiled and the process could continue. So we just added that language in there to reflect what we thought we had said, but we weren't sure right now.
And Representative Norton, that's the key point. The 84 days is the key point, right?
Well, the change is actually adding the language about of which one or two candidates filed who was nominated at a primary. So that's the key language that's changing. But yes, it still has to comply with that 84
right.
days
okay.
for HABA.
Ms. Fraser, anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does deal with the situation of somebody who died after being nominated at a primary. Right now, 84 days is about 1 week after the primary, so that's not a long period, but of course it is possible It also deals with the situation where only one or two candidates filed and narrows it down to that. So that if, for example, 10 candidates filed for a mayor's position and one dies, the current language in the bill as introduced would have kicked off a whole new filing period. And that was not the author's intent. And so this narrows it down to cases where only one or two candidates had filed.
Okay. Members, any questions or concerns or comments about the A1 amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor of the... Oh, I guess I have to move. I'll move the A1 amendment as well. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Before we vote, any other comments from either of the testifiers? Okay. Any comments or questions or concerns from members on the bill as amended? Okay. Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 122, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Norton and Ms. Fraser. Now we will move on to a broader discussion of the thornier, more difficult issue, which is the partisan election issue. And Ms. Fraser, let me just say, you had shown me the... Okay, you have the handouts? Good. So, members, just by way of background, this is a difficult issue. This is what I'll call sort of the Wellstone issue, where a candidate dies suddenly or withdraws for another reason, but death is the most obvious example, after the ballots have already gone out. What do you do in that instance? And it's different for a lot of reasons for partisan races than nonpartisan races. And after the Wellstone death, the legislature actually came up with a solution. But for reasons having to do with changes in federal law that we may or may not get into today, we have to now change that. That reason is no longer good. It will no longer work. And so there's been an informal bipartisan working group that's been meeting on this at the invitation of the Secretary of State's office, attended by officers and the chairs and vice chairs of both the DFL party and the Republican Party, and legislators from all four caucuses. And at the last meeting, which I attended most of, there was a rough consensus. Of course, this committee will have a say about that. You may agree or disagree with parts of what the consensus was, but I think there was a rough consensus about which way to go. And Ms. Fraser has kindly offered kind of a summary here. And before I get to the summary, which I assume you'll want to walk through a little bit, let me just describe how at least I see the issue. So there were some menu items that were presented by the Secretary of State's office at one of the first meetings. And I'm interested in committee members' feedback or thoughts, negative or positive. Menu item number one, let's call it, was to say, and I'll put it in 2002 terms so you can just separate it with, or you can link it to people and not just an abstract concept. So one would be the idea that assuming all the ballots have been printed and absentee ballots have gone out and a candidate dies, one solution would be to say, well, a vote for Wellstone will be counted as a vote for Mondale in that situation. As you remember, Walter Mondale was nominated by the DFL to take the place of the deceased Paul Wellstone on the ballot. And at least those assembled in the room, by and large, concluded that Minnesotans would not take too kindly to that recommendation. We're a fiercely independent bunch as a state. We elect Democrats, we elect Republicans, we elect independents. And to simply say that because you voted for one Democrat or one Republican that it transfers over to whoever that party cares to nominate in that person's stead, our thought in the room was that that would not be an appetizing option and that Minnesotans probably wouldn't like that. Option number two, or menu item number two, would be to say, and let's just put it in terms of death and not withdrawal for other reasons. We'll get to that later. But option number two would be to say, okay, if the dead candidate wins, then there will be a special election. The problem, though, with that one, at least from the standpoint of almost everyone in the room, was it puts people in the awkward position of doing what Representative Norton just described, where the family, or more likely the political party, is in the position of telling people in Minnesota to vote for the dead candidate. Why? Because that political party wants to hold that office, and it's in their interest to trigger a special election so that they can live to fight another day for whatever position it is, U.S. Senator, Auditor, Governor, whatever. So it's in their interest then for weeks, maybe months, depending on when the candidate dies, to say, vote for the dead candidate. So we found that generally that was unappetizing as well. It's a really weird kind of result. And so the third menu item that came up was to say, okay, if a candidate, and it would have to be a major party candidate, with all due respect to the other parties, if the Socialist Workers Party candidate dies, we're probably not going to cancel the election. But if a major party candidate dies, then that automatically triggers a special election. So the election, in the case of 2002 then, if we were looking back, would have essentially been canceled for that race. Though the ballots have gone out, though they're all printed, it would have been null and void, and we would have said that some period afterwards there would be a special election, say 90 days, for example. So 13 weeks would be 91 days, to be precise. So you could say 91 days after there's a special election. And that seemed to us, at least in the room, to be the fairest of those menu options. I very crudely made this about 10 minutes before the committee hearing in my terrible handwriting, but it was just my way of sort of thinking of the continuum in the three periods we have to think about. So in August, there's a primary. Then sometime by the end of the month, I think Ms. Fraser said last time it would have been the equivalent of August 28th. That's when the ballots are printed, absentee ballots sent out. That's kind of the point of no return. Then I just arbitrarily said, let's say in September, sometime in September, the vacancy occurs. And let's just, for ease of use, just assume it's a death and not some other reason, and we'll get to what the other reasons might be. So then there's the period between the vacancy and the election. What do you do there? This sort of idea would be to say, well, there's not much to do there. You would just say that election, if it's a major party candidate that dies, there is no election on election day. But then you have to figure out what happens between election day and swearing in, and what happens between swearing in and the special election. Who appoints and under what circumstances? Is it the same person? Is it two different people? We could all think of a lot of different combinations. So this is the basic issue in my sort of cave drawing here about what we're really looking at and figuring out those different periods. So, Ms. Fraser, I'll hand it over to you. I'm sure you'll have a different way of discussing it, but that was just the way that I thought of it. So if you want to say what you're going to say, Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. So this issue has been around since 2002, and the issue, the process that we used when Senator Wellstone died is no longer an option for Minnesota because of several federal laws that have passed. And so back in 2002, when he died, the process basically said that in that case, the party names a new candidate. We do up new ballots on a photocopy machine and pass them out to voters and hand count them. And if absentee voters want a new ballot, they can request one and then can be sent one. They have to get it back in time by election day in order to be counted. Those are no longer options because of two different federal laws that passed. One is the Help America Vote Act, which requires that accessible voting equipment be available for all federal elections. And the legislature extended this to all elections with the exception of some very small township elections, which means that we can't just photocopy ballots. Ballots need to be able to be machine readable so that we can use accessible equipment so that people with visual or other disabilities can read the ballot or have it read to them and vote privately and independently. And of course, printing doesn't take that long, but reprogramming all of the equipment and testing it and reinserting new devices into the equipment or cards into the equipment is time consuming and expensive and not readily doable. The other law that passed was the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act in 2009. And this law requires that for federal elections, we have at least a 45-day absentee ballot period that especially for military and overseas voters, that their ballots be sent at least 45 days before the election. The legislature decided that that should also be the case for state and county elections, with the exception of state legislative special elections. So that's another issue where if something were to happen after the ballots had gone out, at least for a federal race, we would not be able to have a 46-day absentee ballot period without extending the time beyond the election when we were accepting ballots. And so each federal election, we've kind of held our breath and thanked goodness that none of the federal candidates for office, anything happened to them, because if they had, the U.S. Department of Justice has been very aggressive at coming in and telling states what they need to do in order to ensure this 45-day absentee ballot period. So this is an issue that we need to address, at least for federal candidates, unless we want to risk the U.S. Department of Justice coming in and running our election for us in the case of some sort of tragedy like this. And it makes sense to also straighten it out for state-level races, because right now we have laws that are in conflict. We have laws that say photocopy ballots, and we have laws that say ballots must be accessible, and we can't do both. And so were there some sort of tragedy in a state-level race, there would likely be lawsuits, and then the courts would decide which of the laws had to be followed. And we would prefer that we have an orderly approach and know what needs to happen in the case of a tragedy like this. So in this group that we pulled together that, as Chair Simon said, included representatives from all four caucuses. Representative Sanders was actively involved, as were you, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, and Senator Newman, as well as representatives of the DFL and Republican parties. And as we talked through the issues, this is what seemed to make sense to that group. The first had to do with withdrawal from office. And there was a situation this past year with a legislative district in Duluth where a candidate withdrew in late August. And we were actually pretty surprised that the court allowed the candidate to withdraw, because our reading of the statute did not allow for a candidate to withdraw for just any reason. But apparently the court found the statutes ambiguous and did allow the candidate to withdraw at that point, and the party named a replacement candidate. So one of the first questions that this group grappled with was whether it's appropriate to allow candidates to withdraw after the filing period and the two-day withdrawal period for any reason. And what this group concluded was that after that two-day withdrawal period, unless there are unless there's a catastrophic illness or a death, that candidates should not be allowed to withdraw. That at that point, you've put your name in the ring, your name will stay in the ring. If you decide to stop campaigning, you can do that, but we're not going to change the ballots.
And Ms. Fraser, if I may, I mean, I know some of our views on this may be colored by what happened this last summer with that candidate, but if you step away from that and just think about kind of the long term and other instances that might arise, I mean, let's just face the issue here. What about scandal is the idea. And the problem is, how do you define that in statute? Very, very difficult. And secondly, if you allow withdrawal for any reason, I'm sure all of us could imagine the situation. Take a legislative seat, for example. There's a DFL candidate and a Republican candidate and an open seat, and the DFL candidate, and everyone thought it would be a real firefight, a real neck-and-neck race, but the Republican candidate has really pulled ahead. It's obvious to everyone. And then suddenly in October, the DFL decides that that candidate will withdraw in favor of the popular mayor to make it a race. I mean, there are ways, unfortunately, if we leave it ambiguous, to sort of game the system that way. Probably not likely, I'll admit, but it's really difficult to put in statute some definition of embarrassment or scandal. And notwithstanding what happened last summer, I mean, just think about it in future elections, and hopefully this will never recur for decades. But if it does, that was at least our thinking. But go on, Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest spoke about the laws passed after Governor Carlson was elected, after running again, and after candidate Grunseth dropped out of that race, and how she thought that the statutes had been changed so that it was not possible for a candidate to withdraw for that reason, and felt that the legislature back then had made that decision, but that the courts apparently found it ambiguous and did allow a candidate to withdraw.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Fraser, would you just review for us the procedure by which Governor Carlson is able to be placed on the ballot that year?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, my understanding is that candidate Grunseth filed an affidavit of withdrawal, and that the Republican Party of Minnesota put forward Arnie Carlson's name as the replacement candidate, and that then there were supplemental ballots created, photocopied, and handed out to voters. And
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Ms. Fraser, I think it was that Governor Carlson was put forward as a candidate because he was second in the primary. I don't think the party took another action. I think that's the way it was.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, this is before my time, so I apologize. I'm not familiar.
Representative Erdahl, anything else to add? So it was, I take it maybe it was a Republican Party decision. I mean, are you suggesting that maybe at the time it was state statute that the second place finisher, or that the Republican Party chose him for that reason?
Mr. Chairman, that's what I don't know. And I went through this, but I don't recall right now what the procedures were. And that's what I was wondering, if there, you know, how he had been placed on the ballot. But I do remember that he was second in the primary. And when John Grunseth did drop out of the race, that the ruling was then that because he was the second choice of Republicans and the first choice was gone, that he would then be the choice.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just go back to your comments that you had made in the scenario, not the comments, but the scenario that you set forward to define this. Because I want to make sure I heard it right, because I may or may not have a question depending upon whether I heard it right. And the part that I was questioning or wanting to review is, we had two candidates that were in the race, and a candidate withdrawing, we put the popular mayor in. Under what circumstances were you setting that scenario?
Well, Representative O'Driscoll, I was just saying that absent any other law change, in light of the Supreme Court's ruling in the case of the Duluth area legislator, I don't know what limits there are right now, if any, based on the Supreme Court ruling on reasons for withdrawal. It doesn't have to be. I mean, death is the obvious one, of course. But health, we do have something in statute about health right now, although maybe Ms. Fraser will get to the fact that we probably want to amend that in terms of just fairness. But other than that, the sky's kind of the limit as we read it. And so the point is that the reason we're here in discussing this is because if we don't write anything into statute, then presumably anyone can withdraw for any reason, almost at any time. Convenience, polls, anything like that. So that's the issue. Ms. Fraser, am I getting that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the working group basically is recommending that that there still be a withdrawal period immediately following the filing period, but that after the end of that two-day withdrawal period, candidates are basically not allowed to withdraw, with the exception of a catastrophic illness. So the situation we're talking about would occur in one of three situations. One is has to do with withdrawals during that withdrawal period. So if, for example, there is only one candidate who files for office with a major political party, so, for example, you, Mr. Chair, file for re-election, and then during that two-day period, change your mind and withdraw. What happens? Because if you were the only candidate for your party for the DFL, your name would have automatically appeared on the general election ballot. But now that you've withdrawn during that two-day period, the DFL does not have a candidate. So that's one situation. A second situation is that the name of a candidate who is going to appear on the general election ballot dies. And that could be one of two situations. One is if, again, there's only one candidate from a major political party who filed, they don't have a primary opponent, so they automatically appear on the general election ballot. They could die. Or if there are one or multiple candidates who file and then the one who wins the primary dies. That's another situation we need to figure out. The third is, and this is reflects current law, and current law limits this to candidates for constitutional office, and it says that major political party candidate for constitutional office if they are diagnosed with an incapacitating illness that will permanently and continuously incapacitate them, preventing the candidate from performing the duties of office, and that under those circumstances they could withdraw, and that the withdrawal would need to be accompanied by affidavits from two doctors swearing that this illness is that incapacitating and that it was diagnosed after the candidate filed for office.
That's Ms. Fraser, you're stating current law.
Yes,
right now,
true.
Right. And I assume you're going to get to the tweak that
the group discussed whether having it diagnosed after the candidate filed for office was appropriate, or whether it may be appropriate to change that piece of this current law somewhat. But the three situations we're looking at are somebody withdraws during the withdrawal period, somebody dies, or somebody develops an incapacitating illness.
Right. And members, that last piece to us seemed shocking when we learned of the law or had our memories refreshed about it. It says that in current law, that two affidavit piece from the, you know, two sworn statements from doctors, it has to have been a condition diagnosed after the filing. That seems remarkably punitive. I mean, what about a cancer survivor? What about someone with, let's face it, a slow-spreading cancer like prostate cancer? I mean, I'm getting graphic here, but it's true. And you can live with that for years. And what if it's been diagnosed 5 years ago, but suddenly after the filing period there's a real problem and it spreads? I don't know that the line of demarcation should be that the condition was diagnosed after the filing. I think that seems unfair to me, and it seemed to the people in the room. I think the point is the person incapacitated regardless of when the condition was diagnosed? That seems the fairest, but I'm open and interested in committee comments. That piece seemed a little shocking, at least to the people in the room, that we would be
right.
That harsh in current law, but as to the medical piece. But go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, the procedure for filling this vacancy and nomination would depend upon exactly when it occurred. And so we're looking at three different time periods. And the first deals with the case where one candidate files for a major political party for a partisan office, and then they choose to withdraw during that withdrawal period. So, for example, Chair Simon files for re-election, and then during the two-day withdrawal period, drops out. So now the DFL has no candidate for that seat. How should that be filled? How should the DFL get to nominate somebody? So the suggestion is that we use the same process that is in current law for nonpartisan candidates and was reflected in the bill that Representative Norton just had in front of you, which is that in that case, there's still time to make changes to the primary ballots. So open up a 5-day filing period and a 2-day withdrawal period. Allow candidates to file for office as they would have the previous week during the regular filing period. And if only one candidate files, then their name goes directly onto the general election ballot. But if more than one candidate files, put their names on the primary election ballot. So that's what we're looking at for that situation. The next time period I've put here as summer, but basically we're talking about before the 84th day before the general election. So this is the same time period outlined in the bill that Representative Norton had. So on or before late August, basically. So if a candidate dies or withdraws because of this incapacitating illness prior to that deadline, that the major political party would name the candidate's replacement, which is what we have in current law. The deadline for naming that replacement would be the 77th day before the general election. This is, as I described before, the latest date in statute for making changes to the general election ballot. So it would give the political party at least a week to name their candidate, depending upon when the vacancy occurred. It could give them several months, again, depending upon when the death or illness occurred. As the group discussed whether other political parties should have the opportunity to name a different candidate since one party's candidate has changed, and the group decided to stick with the procedure in current law, which does not allow any other candidates to change or to be named. And the name of the party's replacement candidate would appear on the general election ballot. We need to use a different procedure if it occurs after the 84th day before the general election. So basically, if it occurs during the fall, because at this point, the general election ballots have already been printed, the equipment has already been programmed, it's too late to make changes without, it's too late to make changes, basically. So as Chair Simon was explaining at the beginning, what the group came around to was that in this case, the general election would effectively be canceled for that race. The names would still appear on the ballot, but the votes would not be counted. There would be a special election on a date certain, and the group talked about something sometime around the second Tuesday in February, which provides enough time for local election officials to do data entry and other wrap-up from the state general election and to prepare for the special election. The absentee ballot period would begin 46 days before then, which would usually fall between Christmas and New Year's. The major political party would name the candidate's replacement, and the deadline for doing so would be 7 days following the general election. So again, this would give the party at least 7 days to choose a candidate if the vacancy occurs right before the general election, but could give the party several months, depending upon, again, when the vacancy occurred. Having it after the general election would allow the party the flexibility to name somebody who had been running for another seat, if they wanted to. Again, other political parties would not have an opportunity to nominate a different candidate.
Ms. Fraser, let me just weigh in on that point, just so members fully understand at least what the group's thinking was here. And this is an interesting political question. We've all run for office, so think about it. Let's imagine, and I'm sure we can in our own political history or political consciousness, let's say there is an incumbent office holder for whatever office who's very popular. Pick a party, doesn't matter. Let's say a very popular Republican candidate of some kind. And because that person's very popular and running for re-election, the DFL, let's face it, doesn't nominate what you'd call a blue-chip candidate, charitably, to put it charitably. We've all seen this happen. Very popular incumbent. You know, the blue-chip candidates don't necessarily come forward. Now, all of a sudden, through death or vacancy due to a health issue, that very popular incumbent withdraws, either dies or withdraws. The question here is, does the other party, not the party affected by the vacancy, does the other party get to say, well, wait a minute, we want a new nominee now, when it was against, you know, popular Republican person X, we nominated this kind of, this no-name candidate, but now that it's an open seat, we want to change our nominee. And we all thought in the room that the fairest result was to say, no, you don't get to. That when you nominate a candidate, and both parties, this could happen to either party, it's an equal opportunity problem, I guess you could say, that when you nominate a candidate, you take your chances. And we thought it was fairest not to reset the board for the other party. So just to repeat, popular candidate X, maybe not the blue chip candidate for the other party, the popular incumbent dies, does the other party, not the party of the person who died or had to withdraw for medical reasons, does the other party get to say, well, now that it's an open seat, we want this heavy hitter to be our nominee? And our answer in the room, at least, was, no, that's not really fair. You take your chances. So I'm interested, you don't have to speak now, there's no bill before us, but interested either now or later when we do have a bill on members' input. But I just wanted to emphasize that point. That was our thought, at least in the room, that the fairest result was to say, no, you're stuck with your nominee, that you chose that nominee, whatever party, as your nominee, and sometimes life is unfair, I suppose. But any thoughts or comments on that particular issue? Or Representative O'Driscoll.
My question is, does that apply to primaries as well? And kind of going back to what Ms. Frazier was saying before about we've got a mechanism for the general election, but what about the mechanism for the primary? You have the two-day withdrawal period. You have a five-day period in which to apply, but what happens if before the primary election there's death or incapacitation that would remove a candidate from the ballot? How do we fill that? I didn't hear that. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's going to be the same model she's explaining right now for the general election in the primary.
Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll, the vacancy and nomination only kicks in if a party would not have someone on the general election ballot. So if you were the only person for your party and your name was going to appear on the primary ballot and something bad happened, not to you, to somebody else, to the candidate, and then in that case it would create a vacancy because otherwise your party would not have somebody on the general election ballot. If, on the other hand, there are two people who have filed with your party and something happens to one of those two, it does not create a vacancy in nomination because your party still has a name that will move forward to the general election ballot. Now, there's actually a question that the group actually didn't figure out related to that situation. So if there are only two candidates and they're going to the primary, and if something happens to one of them, what a legislative choice is, does the remaining living candidate, is that person automatically the party's nominee and therefore going to be listed on the general election ballot? Or are they only listed on the general election ballot if they win the primary? If the person who died wins the primary, that would create a vacancy in nomination, and then the party could name somebody. So that's a legislative choice that we actually don't think
we did
figured out.
And Ms. Fritz, I would just say, and I'm interested in members' comments, of course, I think the fairest thing would be to say, no, it's not automatic. I mean, we can all imagine a situation where our respective political parties has a legitimate candidate and a far less legitimate candidate, let's say, who's in the primary phase, and if the legitimate candidate, so to speak, has to resign or passes away, I think there should be, it seems to me fair to allow at least the option of a write-in or some way for a political party not to be, in essence, stuck with someone who is maybe a gadfly candidate. That just strikes me as fair, but I don't know if members have other comments about that. Representative Mariani.
It's an interesting question. My quick reaction is that I think, but as soon as I say it, I'm going to realize that this hasn't always played itself out, but I think what we're trying to respond to are, you know, things that the insurance agencies will often call acts of God. Now obviously, you know, someone dying, that would probably fall under that broad category, but we clearly have had all sorts of incidences in the past that are less objective, if you will. And so I guess, I think the finding of the group is correct. And for me, I think what I'm guided by is anything we can do to minimize gaming the system reinforces the integrity of the electoral process. Having said that, life is pretty complicated sometimes. But anything that we can do to stay to acts that are really quote-unquote objective in nature and causal effect, that seems to be at least an important initial guide for us.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Ms. Frazier's explanation, but there was one part that I was more curious about that maybe the group has talked about and identified, and maybe they haven't, and that is when a candidate who was on a was Democrat, Republican, both going, something happens to the Republican candidate before the primary. In the general election, there was a suggestion that may become a null and void election. Second Tuesday in February would be the election. Would we have that same derailment on a primary if we had that similar circumstance that happened in that flex period that we're talking about with the general election?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, if there's one Republican candidate who filed and one Democratic candidate who filed, they are automatically the nominees for the general election. And so you're saying if before the primary one of those two candidates dies, what happens? And what we're suggesting, what the group came up with, was in that case, that's basically a vacancy during the summer. And so the political party would get to name the replacement for their party. And that is who would appear on the general election ballot for them. So it would be the, in this case, the Democrat who had filed back in May and the Republican who the Republican Party named would be, would go head-to-head in November.
Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair, the final pieces in terms of this special election in February, one is that all voters who applied for absentee ballots for the general election would automatically be sent ballots for the special election, so that the there's not a burden on people who people showed an interest in voting absentee in the general election. And so the proposal is that we say, okay, therefore they are interested in voting and we will just send them a ballot without them needing to reapply for a ballot in this case. And the other thing the group talked about was that in the case of a statewide special election, the state would reimburse the Secretary of State and local election officials for the costs involved in the election because this is an unplanned circumstance and statewide elections are expensive. They cost about $2 million. So there are a couple special situations that we also talked about or need to figure out. And one is the case of a lieutenant governor candidate. So if a a governor candidate files and names their lieutenant governor candidate. So what if something happens not to the gubernatorial candidate, but to the candidate for lieutenant governor? What should happen? Current law says that the gubernatorial candidate names the new lieutenant gubernatorial candidate. So the proposal is that that's what would happen if it happened during the summer when there's still time for the ballots to be changed, and then the general election ballots would reflect the gubernatorial candidate and the replacement lieutenant gubernatorial candidate. But that if the ballots have already been printed, that this is a case where it would not cancel the election and trigger a special election, that the gubernatorial candidate would still say, my new lieutenant governor candidate is so-and-so, but the ballots would not necessarily reflect that change. The other thing that we talked about was the case where the vacancy, where the death or incapacitation was an incumbent. So then you have the question of not only how do we fill this seat for the future, but what happens immediately or when the new term begins, because the special election isn't until February. And so there are three different circumstances we came up with. One was that if it was the governor, the lieutenant governor, of course, assumes the office, and under the Constitution, that person would serve until the new governor is elected at the special election. That's what happened back in 62 when there was the recount between Governor Anderson and
Rollbaugh.
And right. So the previous governor continued to serve until the recount was done. If it was a legislator, the group said the office would remain vacant until the replacement is elected at the special election. So there would just be an empty seat, as there is right now, for the two candidates, or the two people who were elected who resigned. If it was the Attorney General, Secretary of State, or State Auditor, the governor would appoint the replacement.
And Ms. Fraser, that's current law.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And the question was, what happens at the change of terms? So what this group talked about was, if there was a death in October, the current governor would appoint a replacement. And what the group talked about was that person would serve until the first Monday in January, at which point there may be a new governor, and that the new governor would then have the opportunity to appoint a replacement. And, of course, it could be the same person that the previous governor appointed. And that person would serve until the results of the special election are finalized.
And, members, let me just point out something that's not in this proposal that we thought about, but you're free to comment on and disagree with. So we thought about this. So picture the period between swearing in and the special election. It's depicted as three on the chicken scratch here. So that period number three, the governor, be it a new governor who's also sworn in early January, or the old governor who is reelected, whoever the governor is as of that first day of the term, gets to appoint during that, basically, somebody to fill that constitutional office during the one-month period. We thought about, should we prohibit that governor from appointing as that interim one of the candidates in the upcoming special election? We could all imagine the situation where, to give that candidate a leg up, let's say a DFL governor appoints candidate X in the special election as the acting auditor, so that that person can run ads saying, well, I'm already doing the job, I'm already kind of an incumbent, that sort of thing. And we decided that to just leave that alone and not say anything about that. So technically, a governor could do that. It would probably not be politically smart. Voters would probably see it for what it is, which is a way to put the thumb on the scale and influence the election. But, you know, let voters figure that out was our idea. But we could have, and still could, I suppose, put something in there prohibiting the appointment for period three from being a candidate who has filed in the special election. We could do that. I don't have a super strong opinion about it, but I think in the room the sense was, let's just leave it alone. You can't legislate against people making politically unwise decisions. We didn't see the need for that, but maybe one of you do. I don't know. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification, Ms. Frazier, that the vacancies in office is on the last page of the handout. You were talking about if there's a vacancy for governor, the lieutenant governor would assume the office. This person would serve until a new governor is elected in a special election. Is that current law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dowd, that's my understanding of the constitutional requirement, that a governor serves until his or her successor is elected and sworn in.
And in this case,
and so
that
because the lieutenant governor, excuse me.
Oh, I think I might be reading this wrong. So this is not. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Frazier. This is not in the instance that these people are newly elected. The governor and lieutenant governor are newly elected. Maybe after the election, the governor passes away or is incapacitated. What happens then? The lieutenant governor becomes the governor and stays the governor. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, if Representative Dowd, if a gubernatorial candidate who won the election then in December died, I believe that when, maybe Mr. Gehring can help me. I mean, so normally that person would have been sworn in on the first Monday in January. So I guess the question is whether the lieutenant gubernatorial candidate is sworn in on the first Monday in January.
Ms. Frazier, let me see. Mr. Gehring, oh, you have laryngitis, I'm told. Okay. Okay. Well, that's okay. I mean, we don't have a bill before us. This is just conceptual, but that's an important point. We can
Mr. Chair, Representative Dowd, the vacancies in office, this section basically reflects current law. And so I don't think that the group is actually suggesting any changes or clarifications here, perhaps with the exception that a newly elected governor would have the opportunity to appoint a different replacement for Attorney General, Secretary of State, or State Auditor. Other than that, this is an attempt, at least, my attempt at least, to reflect current law.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Frazier. I noticed as we were visiting that the line above that says if the candidate who died or became incapacitated was an incumbent. So I see that there's a condition on that. So, and then as to your other comment about should we be resetting the clock for the other party, my hope is that we're always, political parties are always running their strongest candidates. I understand that may not always happen. And I frankly, I agree with you that we probably shouldn't be resetting the clock for the other party either. So just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Frazier, anything else in terms of your summary?
Mr. Chair, this is an overview of the issue and my understanding, at least, of kind of where the small working group came to, and very interested in any comments or questions or suggestions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
this is, I find, very intriguing when we get into these policy kinds of matters, as you well know. No contemplation from the working group on what to do with legislative vacancies, am I correct?
Well, Representative Driscoll, we thought that legislative vacancies seem to be different from some of these other executive-type positions, and we thought, since our tradition anyway is to leave a seat basically vacant, you know, if someone resigns in the middle of a term for whatever reason, not in the context of an election, but to take a job, as one of our colleagues just did, or to take a position in a gubernatorial administration, we just sort of leave it vacant, call a special election within a few weeks, and we decided, at least our thinking was, not to disturb that tradition.
I would endorse that. I think that that's good public policy to be able to do that. Otherwise, you really can politicize something that doesn't need to become politicized.
So we decided to leave that alone. You know, and generally, I'm interested in any comments you have today, members, but also there is no bill here before us, obviously. This is a concept. We wanted to sort of roll it out here and see what members thought. I know this is, for some of you, kind of an ambush. You haven't had a chance to digest this, but over the next few days, whether you want to do it on the record and openly here at a hearing, or pull some of us aside and talk about either Ms. Fraser or me or Representative Sanders or anyone else, your thoughts about what should be in a bill, I think probably sooner rather than later we should get a bill before the committee so we can really deal with the language here. But just wanted to give you the benefit of the group's thinking. Again, not binding on you. We're all governing here together in this committee because it is a bipartisan committee. So it's going to have bipartisan support. So if you have reservations or an improvement upon what this working group has sort of temporarily concluded, please do let us know. But this seemed to be our best attempt at a workable solution. Again, they're all kind of unappetizing, but it's a question of choosing the least unappetizing, I guess you'd say. Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, And obviously I'm going to express some of my ignorance about the election laws, but what about the emerging instant runoff voting scenarios? Do any of these things, should we be thinking about any of this within that context, or do they not apply under current state laws?
Well, Ms. Fraser can correct me if I'm off here, but since there is no situation of instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting in a partisan context, it really wouldn't be part of this bill. The only place that I know of in Minnesota is the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul that do instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting, so probably wouldn't apply here, but who knows, you know, someday if that's an issue. It isn't for now, but Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, it also is dealing with a situation where we're talking about the party choosing its nominee who's going to appear on the general election ballot. And there may be circumstances where there were several candidates in a primary and one is chosen, and if there had been some sort of ranking that you could say, well, then that person is now the nominee. But we're mostly dealing with situations where there is only one candidate and then there's no one to rank. And so I think in many circumstances it wouldn't be applicable.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, it's certainly been interesting dealing with a lot of these topics, especially since I was working with Representative Simon and Ms. Fraser on at least the vacancy and nomination on the judicial side of things, which turned into kind of more just a nonpartisan vacancy and nomination, which worked, but not exactly perhaps maybe the best for those communities once they are realized. I think it's important that we have as clearly defined system as with as much integrity as absolute possible. You know, it's my understanding, and it seems to be fairly well accepted, that kind of the judicial situation we had in the 10th district was due to political gamesmanship. And so I think it's important, I'll say overall on the partisan side of things, that we have a very, very clear, bright line as far as a withdrawal date goes. And that we don't allow withdrawals or changes after that point in time, and we can work around that. Certainly, we're dealing with trying to make this as economically viable as possible for the state, for the communities, as well as dealing with all the time, all the timeline issues that we have. With that being said, Representative Mariani, you're right. We can't anticipate every act of God that might happen. So, as clearly defined a system that we can have, I think one of the guiding things for me will be how clear and bright is that withdrawal line. I think we've done a very good job on the nonpartisan side of things, and I think that can transfer over just fine. But it's a very interesting conversation, and now something that I do believe we need to deal with, especially with the Supreme Court ruling this past year. So look forward to working with everyone to make sure that we arrive at a good piece of legislation.
Members, any other thoughts or comments about this? And again, you can talk about it privately as well, but this is just the idea. And I think what we'll do then, since there aren't any so far, we'll just get a bill drafted so probably sooner rather than later so we can discuss it and hopefully pass something. But at least you're apprised of what it would – this is only the first pass of at least two that we'll have at this information. Just one couple housekeeping items. I want to make sure that Vice Chair Halverson, have you reviewed the minutes from January 22nd? Would you like to – move approval of the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have had the opportunity to review the minutes, and I move approval of the minutes.
Okay, Representative Halverson moves approval of the minutes. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is motion prevails. Housekeeping-wise, members, next Tuesday, I think we're going to be hearing, you'll see the formal notice soon, two bills, I think. Representative Hansen will have his bill on adding county commissioners and judges to the economic interest disclosure requirement in state law. And then there will be another bill having to do with Soil and Water Commission members in terms of disclosure. It's pretty technical as well, that has bipartisan authorship. So that's up for Tuesday. We're not quite sure yet about Thursday. I'll be discussing that with Representative Sanders and others. But with that, members, unless there's anything else, the committee's adjourned.